Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
You hear that? A woodpecker. Here? A bird that pounds its face into the wood, looking for bugs to eat. Is that my spirit animal? Welcome, everybody, to another edition of the Chicago Way Podcast. I'm John Cass, columnist at the Chicago Tribune, member of its editorial board. And Jeff Carlin is here, as always, my buddy, master of sound, co-host here, executive producer at WGN Radio. And Paul Vallis is joining us to talk about Mayor Wokefoot and that elected school board that the Democrats just gave her. Welcome to politics, Lori. But first, I want to talk about the pandemic. You know about the pandemic. You've thought about it, too, and because you can't stop thinking about it. It's everywhere. Anthony Fauci, the Saint Anthony Fauci of the pandemic, the political operative, political bureaucrat. Well, his emails came out. Thousands of them were released. And I wasn't able to read them all. I don't think you were either. But they're going to be interesting. And they will tell us about Anthony Fauci's role in that lab in Wuhan. The lab where the virus may have leaked out and infected the world, killing 3 million people, more, maybe 3.5 million, and some 500,000, 600,000 people in the United States. Rand Paul, Senator Rand Paul, the senator from Kentucky, Republican, the independent libertarian, conservative, the choice, my choice for president of the United States. Yeah, I wasn't a big Trump guy. Rand Paul was my choice because he believes in something called the Constitution of the United States. He's irascible. He aggravates people on the right and the left. I'm sorry. He aggravates people on the Democratic left and establishment Republicans. I'm wondering if maybe he should get another chance at it. So Rand Paul tweeted out, when those emails came out, the Fauci emails, he tweeted out two words: told you, fire Fauci.
Government defenders of gain of function, such as yourself, say that COVID-19 mutations were random and not designed by man. But interestingly, the technique that Dr. Barrick developed forces mutations by serial passage through cell culture that the mutations appear to be natural. In fact, Dr. Barrick named the technique the no-see-um technique because the mutations appear naturally. Nicholas Baker in the New York Magazine said nobody would know if the virus had been fabricated in a laboratory or grown in nature. Government authorities in the U.S., including yourself, unequivocally deny that COVID-19 could have escaped a lab. But even Dr. Xi in Wuhan wasn't so sure. According to Nicholas Baker, Dr. Xi wondered, could this new virus have come from her own laboratory? She checked her records frantically and found no matches. That really took a load off my mind, she said. I had not slept for days. The director of the gain-of-function research in Wuhan couldn't sleep because she was terrified that it might be in her lab. Dr. Barrick, an advocate of gain-of-function research, admits the main problem that the Institute of Virology has is the outbreak occurred in close proximity. What are the odds? Barrick responded, could you rule out a laboratory escape? The answer in this case is probably not. Will you, in front of this group, categorically say that the COVID-19 could not have occurred through serial passage in a laboratory?
I do not have any accounting of what the Chinese may have done, and I'm fully in favor of any further investigation of what went on in China. However, I will repeat again, the NIH and NIAID categorically has not funded gain-of-function research to be conducted in the Wuhan Institute.
Let's see where this leads. One thing we do know, little children are still wearing masks outside. Their parents are nervous still because of what Fauci and others have talked about. And I'm not going to tell parents how to raise their kids, okay? You want to put them in masks? Fine. You want them in masks when they're playing Little League, sweating, sneezing through the masks? Fine. It's up to you. You're the parent. Betty and I were always concerned and careful parents, I think. We made mistakes, sure. But we didn't make mistakes. Neither of us would talk on a cell phone while we're pushing the stroller into traffic, crossing a red light. You've seen that happen. We didn't do it. We were careful. And many parents are careful. I'd say most parents are careful. So I'm not going to tell you how to raise your kids. But I just want you to think, those masks on little children, what are they being taught? How are they being conditioned by the fear of adults? And what kind of adults will they become with this imprinting of fear upon them and this risk-averse mask-wearing? What kind of biddable subjects will they be in the future? I already see, you know, teenagers and young adults seeking safe spaces, afraid to be challenged by thoughts and ideas, and reverting only to slogans. And I wonder, the masks, what kind of psychological imprinting has happened in their minds? We'll talk about all this with Paul Vallis and Jeff Carlin and me. And you are listening. You know, the Chicago Way relies on you. We rely on you to tell your friends, to find us on Google, Stitcher, Google Play, iTunes, wherever you get your podcasts. And if you go on iTunes, please give us a 5-star review or excellent review. I'm not going to tell you what to give us, but I'll know. And I'd appreciate it, especially now with everything up in the air for me. And for you, as you're on the Chicago Way, remember this. You have to read the signs. You have to read the signals. You have to think about the holes in it, the potholes in it. You could break an ankle. For some, it's the boulevard of broken dreams. And for others, it's the road to opportunity. The Chicago Way on WGN Plus.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man.
Castle.
There was a man who took a stand with pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso. In a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago Way.
Castle.
Jeff, is this becoming the Lori Lightfoot, Lori Wokefoot hour? Because we didn't want to do it that way, just the way the news is breaking.
Yeah, I mean, we did absolutely not. I mean, that's not the point here. The Chicago Way is about the nonsense that happens in Chicago politics. And unfortunately, they all kind of center around the mayor right now.
Well, the mayor is the center of the universe, the Chicago political universe. But yeah. First, I want to, before we get to the Tribune's stellar reporting on the riots and the devastation.
Yeah, hat tip.
Or too. I'm sorry, what do you call them? Civil unrest and mostly peaceful protests that cost people their lives and their fortunes. Yeah. Can we talk about Fauci?
So I have never heard of him.
You're Mr. Science of this podcast. And can you explain to me what is going on with, you know, Rand Paul came out and said two words on a Twitter, on a tweet, told you, and then hashtag fire Fauci.
Yeah.
Tell us what we're looking at here with all these thousands of emails that have just been released.
Yeah, I mean, we won't even get into how they were released because that's a whole other interesting piece. But, you know, I, up front, I'm not the foremost expert on the Fauci situation because a lot of what I do these days is focused local. Right. But I obviously, like John said, it's science and I'm really interested in this stuff. The Fauci stuff is basically comes down to that. The backstory is the NIH, you know, National Institute for Health, is funding this lab to develop, to figure out how to spot emerging viruses and disease from other parts of the world. And Fauci was very important in getting that funding happening and developing this program that would monitor outbreaks, much like we got after the swine flu and SARS and all that stuff. That's where we started in 2019. At the end of 2019, there were reports coming out of China that there was some sort of disease that was popping up. No one was sure what it was, but they were pretty sure it was along this line of viruses that are coming out of the animal world, similar to what we've been seeing in the SARS and other COVIDs and all that. Fauci got word that they weren't sure what it was and that it could have come from this lab, but it could have come from the nearby samples of bats taken from this lab to this lab, but we don't know. And flash forward, we get more evidence that people are saying that this lab was definitely using U.S. tax dollars in an illicit way, or may have been. And Fauci gets that information and is, and by illicit, I mean using this to weaponize these diseases that they were studying, rightfully so, and with our help, unfortunately. And they get the evidence that they may have, either by accident or by malfeasance or by some other means, one of these test subjects, meaning a virus, got loose into people working at the lab and they got sick. He tamped it down at the time, saying we don't have enough to know, we don't know, and we've got other things to focus on, kind of stuff. Move forward, it looks more and more like that the virus came out of the lab and infected the world, as opposed to the other way around.
It didn't come from the hapless corpse of a pangolin at the wet market? No.
Oh well, yeah. It may have started there, but more likely a bat and had been modified by the Chinese. Now, I will say that there are groups that scientists who work with this lab in Chicago with the company called the World Eco Alliance. Their initial, and even today, they are saying that the DNA of this virus itself is probably too advanced to be human made, that we just essentially saying that we don't have the technology really to get to pick and choose and build a virus like this. But, you know, they are just coming off of data that was pre-COVID. So who knows? I think it sounds like, and then John, I know you were talking about this offline, that it looks like Fauci was caught in a rock in a hard place trying to cover his ass because he knows he's attached to this lab and he's got a history with this lab. And this lab was supposed to be doing valuable work, which they're doing in other parts of the world in a similar program with other labs, but they're just not Chinese-run labs.
There's nothing more valuable than modifying a natural coronavirus so that it can attack humans so you can study it. Oh, and it might leak out of a lab. You know, that's where we are. And unfortunately for Dr. Fauci and the news media, everybody downplayed the Wuhan lab leak story at the beginning because of Trump, because they wanted to weaponize the coronavirus to attack Trump politically. And of course, he had said stupid things about, you know, bleach and
I mean,
it's only like the flu and it'll be gone in 10 days. But the larger question is, to me, the media was complicit with their allies, Democrats. And by media, I don't mean local media, and I don't mean court reporters and people who cover the military and nationally. I'm talking about the political media in the Washington Beltway, the New York, Washington axis of evil. Mm-hmm. And they covered it up, and they said it was nothing. And if you, even after writing about it last week, the New York Times reporter, science reporter, said in a tweet that if you think about the Wuhan lab leak, then you're a racist.
Yeah.
And I'm dumbfounded by that, but that's where we are.
Yeah. And I know you say you're calling covering for it. I won't call it that far just because I don't have any proof. I mean, I don't see anybody explicitly saying that they're covering for something because they're trying to protect someone like that. That would alludes to me. It more to your point was this is an anti-Trumpian sentiment that anybody, you know, because at the time there were lots of conspiracy theories about lots of things, not just COVID, but, you know, the world was dealing with the whole Q phenomenon, which was hitting starting to hit its major stride.
I get accused by my leftist trolls who are in the basement of their mommy's homes that I'm like stuff. Q person or whatever. I don't even know what they think it's odd, but mm-hmm. I'm lying, but I've never gone on Q. Yeah. I don't even know.
I will go on the record now explaining that to get involved with Q, it takes a level of technical savvy that John doesn't really possess. No offense, John, but that's really in your defense that because it's been so hard to be involved with that movement at a base level that you need to go to certain sites or certain places to get the information. And to really be involved in it, John's just not. There's no.
Were with their stupid Pizzagate story or something, sex slaves.
And I'm not downplaying the tendency and the outright bias in media to protect and not want to listen to stories that don't fit their worldview, because that is absolutely happening all the time, every minute, and it's getting worse. There's no doubt about it.
Right.
I'm just trying to lay the table for this, for the moments we were in when this was all developing, which included one of the biggest surges in conspiracy theories across the planet, which tied to this, tied to all sorts of things. And so I'm not surprised that it got tamped down pretty quick. But I'm surprised that it's taken this long for any legitimate sourcing to have come out and been like, listen, we know a lot more than they're telling us. And so I don't know if that's just clandestine systems working at a slower pace to protect sources or whatnot. That now, why are we getting reports that say that the CIA is looking into this and CIA does have some information? It seems weird that if they knew this, then they knew they had evidence. There was credible evidence that this was leaked, either again by accident or on purpose. Why wasn't there an instantaneous bigger call to say, hey, we need to really rethink how this happened?
Because
I don't know.
The Democrats mocked it, because the Washington Post and the New York Times, who set the agenda for the woke newsrooms around the country, mocked it, said it was a conspiracy theory. Tom Cotton, the senator from Arkansas, raised valid questions, saying, "Oh, we don't know enough about this. We have to know more. Maybe did it leak from a lab?" And immediately the headlines from those papers and from CNN and usual suspects of the woke world attacked him as a conspiracy theorist. So it was about politics. The ignorance was about politics.
But I don't understand. I mean, you had the president and his entire cabinet and him controlling essentially government, and he would have easily been a softer road for him to go if he had proof, if they were looking into it and not, you know, not letting the media sway the investigation of what was happening there. That's more my question is, and I know you're right, John. I'm not just kind of,
well, could,
but I don't understand why there was no official, like we didn't have a CIA. I mean, if they had this information, there were these emails, I mean, somebody up the chain of command, because I guarantee you Fauci is not the first person getting emails within the government saying, hey, this thing definitely it needs to be looked at again. So if he's getting those emails, that means there's other people in the chain of command who are getting these emails. So why wasn't there an instantaneous, hey, this is really bad. We need to go after this and find out what's happening. Why wasn't Trump doing that? Is that
a question to me?
Yeah, it's more my question. I mean, okay. In general, but.
Well, maybe it's because, well, Trump and Secretary of State Pompeo said it publicly, but they didn't come with the evidence and right. The argument from New York Times and other woke newsrooms was that, oh, we can't trust Pompeo. We can't trust Trump. Right. It's politics. The fact is they didn't want to even look at it because that would give Trump an advantage or at least a leverage in the election. And they've become political operatives rather than journalists. But the fact remains that if you were the president or anyone and you had this information and you're asked for evidence, what do you do? Do you just turn over your assets, your intelligence assets, and identify them and let the Chinese scoop them up and put them in a Uyghur camp or something, a slave concentration camp, or kill them? You can't. So sources and methods have to be protected.
Well, yeah, true. But nothing, I mean, aside from them saying that, there was no task force. There was no special appointee. I mean, he could have done something to make it more like, this is a serious thing. Look, I'm putting these resources into it and we'll get you answers when we have them. And they could have done that. And, I don't think it's, I mean, the media not believing them is their own fault, but I
think on both sides, on Trump's side and on the media side.
And the political activists are, you know, being a political force as a journal, quote unquote journalist, you're absolutely right. I mean, again, right. It goes back to that idea that they don't want to cover stories they don't want to cover that hurt their friends or people they believe in or whatever. And they're actively, you know, subverting that. I'm just devil's advocate. I don't know. I mean, I don't know what to believe now anymore. And that makes me scary because I always thought I had a good handle on what to believe, John.
That's the point. We're unmoored.
I know.
We're unmoored. You have major American corporations heavily invested in China. Mm-hmm. The NBA, the Disney, Bloomberg, Google, Twitter, I would assume. I don't know if they have the Chinese Twitter accounts where we might find out what Xi Jinping's favorite ice cream flavor is. Maybe he'll hold up a cone on a selfie and show us. But all this investment, it's all about money. And we've been focused. The American public has been focused. Russia, Russia, Russia. Well, there's stuff happening in Russia for sure. Mm-hmm. But Russia, China, and Iran are becoming friends in the Middle East, and
not just the Middle East, John.
Is the problem.
They're becoming friends in Africa, in South America, in Indonesia. That's where they're becoming friends, and then we have zero control over that, and it's dangerous.
Well, the popular discussion in media is, are they testing Biden? And a wise man just told me, they're not testing Biden because they know who Biden is. They know about, they both took care of, you know, Hunter made big money in Ukraine and with the Moscow mayor and his wife and with, and in China. So they know all about the Bidens. Right. They're like the dailies, but, you know, on a larger scale. What they're testing, I think, Jeff, are the American systems. our systems of politics and of cybersecurity.
Yeah, well, I have news for the American public is that we suck at all of that, and we are foolish and silly that we've allowed this to happen to ourselves. Here's my TED talk on that, John, is that the internet in this country was left to be at its own market, which is a transfer of information. You know, that's all it really is. I mean, cut and dry of it. And we used to have this thing where the FCC would fine people, and the way people got information was controlled by them, not controlled, but monitored and whatever. And then they opened up the internet in our country, and we let the whole world have access to the internet, our internet. And I'm saying R because if you understand the internet, their domains are their actual regional. So it is really a thing. Ours versus theirs is not just one big thing. And in doing so, we gave every adversary we have the keys to the castle to come in and mess with our public psyche. And they've been, the Russians and the Chinese and the Iranians have been doing it since the day it started. And they've only gotten better and better, way beyond anything we can do, and weaponize it to change people's minds, create disarray. I mean, we do it. We used to do it in South America, but we were dropping leaflets over people and, you know, starting, quote unquote, resistance groups underground. Now they're doing it to us with our own technology, and we let them. And it's just, it's terrible, really terrible.
Before we close this segment out, can I be a last word freak?
Yes.
The editor of the great magazine, conservative magazine, The Federalist, Ben Domenech, asked the other day, and he's been asking this for quite some time, consider the possibility we are led by idiots.
Yes.
Anyway.
We were talking about the most consequential change in governance for the Chicago public schools. It can't be about the politics. It's got to be about the people. And the people who matter most are our children.
And now, as promised, we have Paul Vallis, my friend, former candidate for mayor, for governor. I guess because I like him, he doesn't win. He never won. And also former chief executive of the Chicago Public Schools, who's been on the issue of getting rid of the lead-lined pipes that destroyed the brains of black and brown children all across the city in poor neighborhoods. Welcome to the Chicago Way, Paul.
Thanks for having me, John.
Well, you're kind of busy. One day you're talking with Joan Esposito on, I don't know what it is, socialist radio, and the other day you're on with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson.
And that's right.
Conservative radio. So what is going on with you?
Well, I'm the same guy. I guess everybody wants a moderate, right? Progressive talk wants a moderate, and the conservative radio wants a moderate, too. I'm saying the same things, getting the message out. And I'm finding both audiences to be very reasonable.
Well, if you could only tell Jeff, please understand this. I don't usually give advice to political people or public people, but I've known Paul since we were kids, and I advised him that if he runs for mayor again, I will break his legs.
And I can't do it. You and my wife both.
You're way bigger than me. You could kill me. But
you know, my wife's a former police officer. She still has her service revolvers, as she reminds me. So, all right. Anyway.
All right. So with that in mind, Jeff and I need to ask you the pressing political question. There are signals that politicians send taxpayers. One signal is the re-election of Kim Fox as the state's attorney, as the no lock 'em up, hug the criminal state's attorney. I know people will make this a racial thing, but it is not. It has nothing to do with that. It's just policy. And the other signal that homeowners in Chicago received this week was the decision or move by the Senate in the state of Illinois State Senate, to approve an elected school board over the objections of Lori Lightfoot. What does the elected school board, in a few words, mean for taxpayers, parents, and the city of Chicago?
Well, when you look at the elected school board within the context of the governor signing the bill that allowed the teachers union to strike for whatever reason the teachers union can strike, it really turns de facto control of the schools over to the teachers union, because it's not to suggest that the teachers union is going to be able to get majority membership over the board, but even if they have a number of candidates, maybe they're in the minority, but basically in effect doing the union's bidding, because they have the ability to raise money and they have the ability to put feet on the ground, so to speak, troops in the local campaigns. They will in effect neutralize the mayor's ability to use that board to really set the agenda. So you know, at the very least, the union's going to be able to neutralize the board as a potential vehicle for holding them accountable. And then, of course, having the ability to strike for any reason, whether it's class size, whether it's closing schools again because there's another outbreak of COVID, or whether it's, demanding that that there be hazard pay for teachers that are being directed to return to school. I mean, the unions literally have ultimate leverage. And what it means is it means the schools are going to be less and less institutions that are designed to benefit the kids and more institutions that are designed to benefit the adults, particularly the teachers and the teacher union members. The teachers union has, in fact, become a de facto political organization, and we're seeing the consequences.
I speak as a father of a teacher, a union teacher, the husband of a teacher, and you know, I support teachers. But I think, Jeff, would you agree with Paul that the schools would become de facto controlled by the CTU when this is done?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And since they have such a strong connection and with the Democrats of Cook County, I fear in Chicago, it would be the fix would be entirely in then if come the next election cycle, because in my opinion, the next mayor of this city is going to be extremely closely aligned to the CTU. And therefore, every dollar spent in this city, a part of it would go to the union, essentially. And every decision will be made to benefit them and cost us more money. And that will ultimately, if that happens, and if that's the way it is, which I think it's going to be, we're going to be in a position where it's, you know, I know we've talked about this not necessarily happening anytime soon, but I think this would be put us on the path to becoming a city like Detroit, where it would just be a spiraling downfall of bad decisions one after another that are all politically charged and have nothing to do with services or children or benefiting the populace. That's my take on it.
Paul, do you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. And look, you're seeing it already. We all know that Lori inherited a mess left over by Rahm Emanuel. People need to remember the type of mess that she inherited. But yep. The bottom line is, when she had the power to, in effect, dig in and force the schools to open, as you know, the Catholic schools have been open since August, she caved to the union in effect three times. So the union literally got away with murder. I mean, schools were closed for like 12 months, yet they continued to get their record pay increases. So they got the teachers union contract is the most expensive contract in history. They didn't give up. They didn't add a minute to the school day. They didn't add a minute to the school year. Look, they just got between Trump and Biden, they just got another $2.5 billion from the federal government. Yet schools didn't reopen until April, and they're opening schools for the summer, but only a limited number of schools. And with programs and services to only accommodate about, about maybe a fourth to a third of the students, despite the fact that these students have lost critical instructional time. So at the end of the day, you're already seeing the full impact of the Chicago Teachers Union dominated school system, and it's not benefiting kids whatsoever. And it's going to continue to go down that path. The schools consumed 66% of the property taxes that Illinois taxpayers pay, 50 55% in the city of Chicago, not counting the $500 million teacher pension subsidy, which is also a separate property tax levy. And what do we have to show for it? 12 months of school campuses closed down. This is not in the best interest of the city.
The mayor of Chicago, Mayor Lori Lightfoot, is getting a lot of heat everywhere. She's even getting it from me, a former supporter. But I'm still struck by, you can see what she did years ago when she came in. As you said, she caved to the union. She gave them big money. She aligned herself with the Chicago Teachers Union in part because the white woke progressives were her base on the north side and still are. And she started a war with the police to satisfy them politically. I don't know. What do you think of the wisdom of this gentleman now that we see what happened to the city, violent crime rising? What do you think of the political calculations of this most inexperienced mayor?
Well, look, I have no reason to question her motivations, her honesty, her commitment to the city. I just think, though, not only the mayor, but the Cook County State's Attorney, Fox, I mean, the governor, it's amateur hour. It is absolutely amateur hour. Look at all the things. I mean, think about COVID for a second and all the damage that's been done because of COVID. I mean, and great. Look, I'm certainly recognizing the human costs in terms of the loss of lives and things like that. But the denigration of our economy, the creation of a depression within the service industry that has mostly impacted working families, poor working families, Blacks and Latinos, the devastation caused by keeping schools closed for almost a year. Again, those most of all families impacted, but those most impacted, most adversely impacted, working families, only one in six Black and Latino families can work remotely. I mean, the damage has been done. I mean, we've done it. It's self-inflicted. This is self-inflicted wounds. Caving to the teachers union three times when you could have drawn the line, when you could have forced them to return to work or else lose their pay, and failing to do that when you had the power, of course, that power has been lost. I don't know. I don't think we've ever experienced. We have a crisis in leadership here. And it's not only.
Remember what I told you, I'm going to break your legs if you run for mayor.
Yeah, sorry about that. Okay.
All right.
Sorry, guys.
Yeah, I think you hit on the nose there, Paul. It is, I mean, amateur hour. It's a weird thing, John, for us to say that.
Totally.
We always talk about how it's, you have these career politicians who are in it for themselves, and they may be doing things without the people voting and all that stuff. But now you see when it goes the other way that you need some of that institutional knowledge to get around the crap. I don't know.
Well, you need people who know what they're doing. And she didn't want to take advice. She's living in a political bubble with her wildly far left progressive advisors who have no experience. Maybe the only thing they have is some family connections to the CTU. And that's it. So this is what happens. Now, another subject to ask Paul Vallis and Jeff Carlin. It's the Chicago Tribune story. Amazing. I have to say, my own newspaper, which I love, the Tribune investigation documents the scope of the damage and a lingering impact on neighborhoods and businesses. They call it, we call it in the paper, the headline, Chicago's 2020 unrest.
Yeah.
But, there was all this anguish about calling it riots. They do refer to looting. I think it was it was looting and riots, and the inspector general did not spare Lori Lightfoot by blaming her for not communicating with her police and not being ready for the riots that came and destroyed the Loop and the neighborhoods. I wonder what you think of it, Paul. What do you think of all that?
Well, there's two problems. One is they've really been defunding the police by not filling police vacancies. So there's been fewer and fewer police resources. And as a result, the Brown has been stripping the districts of needed police officers and creating this massive citywide unit. And, you know, so they've been degrading the police department, number one. Number two, they've been restraining the police department's ability to do proactive policing. You've seen it most recently with the severe restrictions on foot chases. And number three, their total lack of preparedness. It's not like you didn't have experienced police officers like Terry Hilliard and others retired who could have easily advised them, on how to prepare for the first protest. It's not like we didn't get warning that there could be trouble back in May. But remember, there was the second mass looting, mass riots in August. So, I mean, what about the second? What about the second abdication of effective management? So it's just really amateur hour. I can't argue. I can't make that point enough. And the dangerous thing with COVID, really quick, John, is that COVID has been used as an excuse by both the mayor and the governor to literally act unilaterally in so many areas. I mean, what happened to a functioning city council? What happened to the legislature? So many decisions are being made by edict, by individuals who simply don't have the qualifications or the experience or the knowledge or the veteran administrators surrounding themselves to enable them to make responsible decisions. So it's a dangerous time for both the city and the state.
And dangerous for the residents of Chicago who are contemplating whether they're going to invest their money and their retirement savings in a home in Chicago. I have to ask you, though, before we close, back as your days as from your days as an educator, I've been thinking about, and I talked about it on the monologue, and for both of you, Jeff and for Paul, the masks and the psychological imprinting of the masks on little children who are still wearing them while they're playing outside, and you see it all the time. And I just wonder, I'm not telling, and I know you won't either, tell parents how to raise their kids. People are afraid of COVID. Some aren't. You know, they look at the information that says children aren't really at risk and they don't really transmit it, and others are terrified of it. Okay, whatever you want to do, that's your family, your life. But I'm thinking about the effect of mask wearing and fear on the generation that's now 4 or 5 years old, 6, 7, playing Little League in the park on a hot, sunny day with a mask on. What do you think that will do? Will it create a generation of, perhaps a generation of risk takers, of Americans that we used to understand as Americans risk takers, or will it create a generation of biddable subjects?
Well, look, I think everything that's being done is designed to create a greater dependency relationship, specifically dependency on government. I believe children have been traumatized. I remember how traumatized I was in first grade when they shifted me from where I was a lefty and they made me right-handed and, you know, to all the some of the things that I had to do as early as first grade. So, my firsthand experience is about how young children can be traumatized. Well, just imagine wearing a mask or doing recess where you got to sit in a circle or not being able to interact with kids. Or, I mean, it's just so much of early schooling is about social interaction. So real damage has been done. The remote learning has been a disaster. And even when kids are in school, the schools are environments of fear. They're environments of fear. And so I think kids have been traumatized. And I think the trauma is going to be long lasting, unfortunately.
I don't have children, but all my friends have children in that age group. And I'll take this the other side of it, that my interaction with them and seeing their kids going to birthday parties now and stuff and seeing going to ball games is that the kids are all wearing masks and they look like normal kids. They're playing like normal kids. They don't seem to be afraid of going out because they stop. I got my mask. It protects me kind of thing. I do think you guys are right with the idea of the dependency piece, and it's certainly going to make it easier in the future to push them into things as a populace. But I don't think the trauma is as severe as we think. Now, I think the class of kids that are really going to take the hardest hit is those with any type of disability. We've seen that without being having a support system that supports those kids 24/7, that they slip or they regress or they don't advance or they stagnate. And those are the groups that I really feel sorry for, and the parents, because that's a really hard world to begin with. And this type of adversity is not going to make it easier and not going to be helpful long term.
No, we've lost those children. My son is a special ed teacher, and he does it because he cares about helping them. And he's just devastated, as are so many special ed teachers. They know what the lack of personal contact has done to the special ed community. But I think all children in schools are if mommy and daddy have means, if you're upper middle class and you're going to Peyton on the way to Harvard and it's all paid for, or Stanford, and you have tutors, that might be one thing. But if you're kids that are disadvantaged, black and brown, and you're kept out of school, you just lost that year, and you probably lost more than that. And the system that is basically run by white people for the benefit of white progressives and political insiders has stepped on you and ground your guts into the dirt. That's what I think.
Well, John, John, it should be telling that 40% of the teachers who have children send their kids not to Chicago public schools, but suburban schools. I think it's twice the national average of public school teachers attending non-public schools. And look, it's clearly had its most adverse impact on the poorest children, yes. But it's impacted all families. I've talked to families, parents furious in the suburbs, in communities where school is everything to these kids. It's the center of their universe. You know what I mean?
It should be.
They're not afraid to go to school, and they've been traumatized. They've lost that year. They're not going to recover that year. The suicide rates, the contemplated suicide rates, the opioid addictions, all increasing, all skyrocketing. And the number of kids killed last year in Chicago, on the streets of Chicago, school-aged children, 83 murdered, almost 600 shot. I think there's 18, 19 more who have been killed this year already, like 100, and I don't know what the number is. It's in the hundreds who have been shot. I mean, there's a COVID connection here. There's, the conditions that we've created. That have put children at much greater risk.
As the last question of the podcast, this move by the Democrats, who are basically in thrall or servants of the Chicago Teachers Union and the teachers unions, it's not a value judgment, it's just fact. And this move to make Chicago an elected school board, which will no doubt not improve education and raise property taxes. I wonder if the response of it would be full and open school choice for everyone, and whether that can even be accomplished now. I'm planning on risking what's left of my career to support school choice throughout the country to help the kids who need it and parents. But I just don't know if in your assessment, Jeff and Paul, if based on what we've seen with the school board issue and the Democrat control, if school choice, real school choice, could ever happen here in Illinois.
It's an uphill climb without the executive leadership leading the way. If anything, you're going to continue to see assaults on school choice. Now, fortunately, parents finally got up in arms, and they effectively blocked the state from getting rid of the scholarship program for poor families. As you well know, they were able to block Pritzker's attempt to lump that in as a what he called corporate tax loophole, a program that provided the scholarship program for poor children. And then, of course, they defeated that bill that was designed to allow the state to shut down parochial and private schools. The teachers union got very embarrassed that parochial and private schools stayed open when they shut down. So they want to empower the state to be able to, next time there's a big shutdown, that it's easier for the state to shut everything down than for the unions to try to get the local county health departments to do that. So those two measures were defeated. So, but you're going to see more measures like that, because if anything, they want to wipe out choice. They want to cap charter schools. They want to limit the voucher program. The only way out for the city of Chicago, and the only way out for these big cities, the only way to break is to end education redlining, is to really provide all families, particularly poor families, with school choice. And that means not only the choice to attend charter schools that aren't capped, that don't have their enrollment capped, but also the choice to attend parochial and private schools. And if we really want to empower the parents, John, very quickly, you know, instead of having an elected school board, why don't we allow the elected school councils to be able to pick better school models when their local schools are failing, like they do in New Orleans, where the community can say, this isn't working. We want a better model for the existing kids in our schools. But the unions don't really want to give parents choice. The objective behind the elected school board is for them just to take what remaining power away that the mayor has to, in effect, block them from continuing to advance their pro-members and anti-child agenda.
Paul Vallis, former candidate for mayor. I guess Lori Lightfoot should have listened to you, but she didn't. Former candidate for governor, director, chief executive of the Chicago Public Schools for many years when they were actually performing well. Thanks for joining us on the Chicago Way, Paul.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bob.
One thing you might not know about Paul Vallis is that he's a movie buff, and Betty and I had our anniversary recently, and he told me to rent, you know, told me not to get Manchester by the Sea on rental and instead get a romantic comedy. He offered one called The Upside of Anger, which I thought was great, with Diane Allen and Kevin Costner. So, you know, that's me, Mr. Romantic Comedy. For Paul Vallis, our guest here, and for Jeff Carlin, executive producer, WGN, Master Baker, Mr. Science, good friend, and Master of Sound, including woodpeckers.
That's me. And John, before we say goodbye, I also want a hat tip to your colleagues at the Tribune on that reporting we were talking about earlier, how good that was, the breakdown of what happened last summer and the looting to Todd Leidy and Chrissy Katowski and our friend Will Lee. And of course, and Richard, so he's calling him Richard Marks, but Gary Marks, who is a friend of the podcast, who has the best stories about Cuba of anybody I know. That's some great reporting. And it was, if you can do yourself a favor, check it out. It really, really lays bare how just poor of a job the city did last summer in handling unrest. So
15 homicides, 53 victims of shootings. 2,100 plus businesses damaged or looted, 71 buildings set on fire, 57 weapons seized, 157 people charged with felonies. Really, Kim Fox, only 157? 7 marijuana dispensaries damaged or looted. Oh, I wonder why. 300,000 instant lottery tickets stolen. Oh, I wonder why. 700,000 plus prescription pills stolen from pharmacies, 3,000 license plates and registration stickers stolen, and a city that won't forget, despite what we in the media do, despite what the politicians do. Oh, look here, open the beaches, or whatever they do. Let's invest in the neighborhoods, whatever they say. People won't forget because of this Tribune newspaper. Because a great city deserves this newspaper, and my colleagues, these colleagues that did this story, are excellent reporters. So for Paul Vallis, Gary Marks, I mean, Gary's not here, he's in the paper. For Paul Vallis, Jeff Carlin, and me, John Cass, columnist for now of the Chicago Tribune, member of its editorial board. Thanks for being here on another edition of the Chicago Way on WGN Plus.